Welcome to the Wicked Wallflowers Club. I'm Jenny Nordback, and this week we're joined by number one New York Times bestselling author Patricia Briggs, who is the author of the Mercy Thompson series and the Alpha and Omega series. We chat about the latest book in the Alpha and Omega series, which is called Wild Sign, as well as her journey as an author, the pressures and expectations that go along with writing a really popular series, and why she made some of the choices she did along the way. With no further ado, here is our interview with Patricia Briggs. All right, we are thrilled to be joined by Patricia Briggs today. Thank you so much for making the time. I was a little bit surprised when you said yes. I was pitching it fully expecting the no. And I was like, oh my God, Patricia Briggs is going to come talk to us.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. I've enjoyed your podcast before. And I thought this would be a really fun way to start the publicity tour for, I can't remember the name, my own book, Wild Sign.
Wild Sign.
Right. Yes. Which is coming out later this month. And it just seemed like a really fun thing to do. So thank you for having me.
Yeah. No, of course. So I thought a good starting point would be, I was typing up talking points in the middle of the night as my kids were sleeping, kind of struggling for that time to myself to work, and read in your bio that that was kind of how your writing career had started as well. You were working a number of odd jobs. You were writing when the baby was napping. Can you kind of tell us what that starting point looked like?
Well, sure. When you're starting as a writer, you write when you can find time. And as a young mother, and with my husband working full time, and I was working, substitute teaching, I worked in a deli, I did a lot of things just trying to make ends meet. And it meant that the time to write was just an hour here, an hour there, when the kids were asleep. Actually, when my husband was asleep, I would go to bed and wait till he went to sleep, then get up and go write. It was, you just do what you have to do if you have been bitten by the bug.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And I mean, I think it's just nice to hear that that's how so many people start, like that you can start there and get to where you are now is a good thing for people to hear.
Well, and I'm not alone. I know a lot of my friends who are writers, who are authors and pretty well-known authors did the same thing. You need quiet to write. You need not interrupted time, uninterrupted time, because people, when they come in and they break your train of thought, it takes you maybe a half hour, 45 minutes to get back to where you were to start out with. So finding time when people are unlikely to come in and bother you is a tough thing. It's a tough thing.
Yeah. And so I guess at some point you must have seen it as a viable enough income source that you could drop the odd jobs and focus on it more full time.
Right. What I remember is when I sold my first book on spec, that would have been Dragon Blood. I just finished Dragon Bones and told them that I had a sequel I was going to work on. And they sent me, they asked me to write up an outline, which I don't do very well. And my editor knows that. I just go, well, this happens and that happens. And if it ends like this, it could end like this. But if it does, it's going to be a terrible book. Hopefully I'll figure out something better along the way, kind of thing. And then they sent me a contract. I looked at it and went, oh, wow, that's why they wanted me to send this up. That's kind of cool. And a friend of mine called to ask me if I wanted to help them on a project and come in and work for them for, it was kind of little odd jobs that I think it was house cleaning, kind of little odd jobs I took all the time. And I looked at the contract and I thought, no, I really don't have time to do that if I'm going to get this book done when they want me to get this book done. And that was pretty much the time when I started to prioritize the writing over over the odd jobs and things like that. So that was before the Mercy
that your
books.
Writing time was more valuable than
correct. Right. Then, $5 okay. an hour. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. was there a moment in that journey, I'm assuming it's after that, where it just something happened or, you were at a book signing or whatever, and you really felt like you had made it, so to speak, as an author?
So Mike and I used to joke. He would say, well, you're not an author until you've written two books. And I would say, okay, yeah, I agree with that. And then I would say, well, I'm not really an author. I just, you know, I don't make a living at it. I just, you know, a little bit here and there. I can remember when one of Mike's coworkers came up to him and said, my brother's wife wants him to quit, and I think it was med school, and support her while she writes a book. And then she will support them writing books. And when he goes back to med school, and I knew your wife was a writer. How do you feel about this? And Mike looked at him, and my husband was a sysop DBA. He was a computer programmer, made pretty good money. But even at that time, we were paying off student loans and things like that. And really my books paid for the computer upgrades and the cars we drove. And Mike had been teased a lot because the car he drove right then was a 15-year-old Volkswagen Jetta that had been sandwiched, you know, hit front and back. We picked it up for like $200 and it was still ran beautifully, right? And he looked him in the face, and he looked him in the eyes, and he goes, my wife's books pay for our cars. And he goes, I'll tell him not to do it, and walked off. So right. So it was, the books became more than a hobby when I got the contract for the Mercy books, and I looked at them and I thought, that's going to be a pretty, you know, it went from being $5,000 a year, to being $15,000 a year. And I thought, hey, that's almost a career. So, and then the, first Mercy book hit the USA Today. It hit the USA Today. And then the second book hit the New York Times as paperbacks. And then Iron Kissed hit number one on the New York Times as a paperback. And I looked at Mike and he looked at me and I'm going, darn, I'm an author. And he looked at me and he said, yeah. And, you're not weird anymore. You're eccentric. New York Times bestselling authors can be eccentric. I'm going, yes, I can do that. So, but really it wasn't until that point that I really felt, I don't know, legitimate is the right word, but maybe felt that the writing was really a career rather than something I did that was really fun and I enjoyed very much.
Yeah. And so you use that word legitimate, and I think imposter syndrome is a thing that we've talked to a number of authors about in the past. Is it something that creeps up on you where you still have those doubts?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I'll be sitting on, well, I can remember sitting on a panel with CJ Cherry on one side, and I can't remember another big name author on the other, and looking around going, what am I doing here? What? this is really, and Carolyn is the nicest person on the planet. I really love her. We're good friends now. But you do feel very strange, and you feel very strange when people are asking you for your opinion about things as if you should know what you're talking about. And we all know as writers, you can have all the crafts boxes you want to, but really the difference between a good story and a not good story is a feeling. You know, it's something that you can't codify really well. I mean, I can pick apart things that make it good, but trying to start with nothing and pulling together a story is an art form. And I always feel like in the middle of the book that I have no business doing what I'm doing. I'm a terrible writer. What do I think I'm doing? This is awful. And I sit down and say, well, I've written 25 books and they do okay and people like them. So maybe I should just get over myself and keep going. Right. But I think
get that in every book.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. I have never written a book, where in the middle of it, I thought I knew what I was doing or that it was very good. Yeah. And then edits, I'll go through the edits. I'm going, wow, I kind of like this scene when I started out and it's really bad. So.
Yeah. Some of it is probably just instinct, and some of it you probably just need space from the book to let your brain.
Pretty much, yeah.
It.
Yeah. Well, and when you go in and edit a book, that's a different frame of mind anyway. When you're telling stories, that's the 5 or 6-year-old kid you used to be, would go play house with your friends and things like that. And you have permission to be bad and to do weird things and to do things that probably won't work. And then you go back with your editor's cap on, and the first thing you look at is go, oh, this is a drivel. This is absolute awful. But you have to have that capability. If you can't look at your own work and be really critical of it, it's really hard to put together a good book.
That's such a good point that like it's okay to be bad as long as you can recognize that it's bad and do the work to fix it.
Right. And I always say there's nothing so bad it can't be fixed. So
that's a good one. So I've jumped right in just assuming, you know, everybody has read your books and that is not true. I know a significant portion of my audience hasn't.
Somebody hasn't read my books?
I know. And, you know, I'm hoping maybe we can change that. So I thought it would be a good idea for those who are listening who have not, they have no experience, they have no idea who Mercy Thompson is, to just kind of give an idea of what the world is for Mercy Thompson in Alpha and Omega, are the two kind of crisscrossing series. And then we can jump more into specifics.
Okay. So, I write urban fantasy, which is sort of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Most people know Buffy or Twilight, where the creatures of the night, the scary things from your childhood are real. Ghosts and goblins and fairies and vampires and werewolves and things like that. Mercy lives in this world and she is a mechanic. She's Native American and she's a shape-shifting coyote. And which gives her this awesome superpower of being 35 pounds, being able to shift into a 35 pound animal and deal with vampires and werewolves. And we have a lot of fun, ensues. And I hope, at least for me, and I hope for readers.
Yeah. And so, I was trying to think how to explain the series and, you know, to someone who's never read it before and just how many different things it is. It's, there's always a mystery to be solved. The characters are in danger. There's adventure. There's romance. We get to sit with these characters for a longer time. Like the romance gets multiple books to develop and evolve. And there's kind of that slow burn. And then there's, all right, now they're together, but like other things keep them apart. Or like Mercy just cannot keep herself out of trouble. And Adam has to deal with that.
I think that's true. I think there's a lot of, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, go on.
So there's a lot to be said about having all of these books to tell a story about your imaginary friends. And it means that I can play. One of the reasons why I started writing fantasy in the beginning was that of all the genres out there, it is the most flexible. As long as the plot turns on magic, then I can write mysteries, I can write spy novels, I can write romances, I can write thrillers, and I can bring that into the Mercy books. And with Mercy, with the urban fantasy, you can bring in horror too. So I'm easily bored. So I try really hard not to bore myself. And so each book is a little bit different and has a little bit, you know, different things going on. Sometimes the romance is front and center, and sometimes, you know, murder mystery is front and center. And sometimes in the same book, it kind of changes up. And if I find myself getting bored, I try to throw something else in there. And so
I was like, what are the ways that you do that? And it's like, you change the setting, you know, it could be somewhere as close as Seattle to, you know, somewhere on the East Coast, or it could be Prague, or we go to a horse ranch, and like the setting changes, but then also you can introduce a brand new magical faction. This brand new piece of mythology that maybe we've seen them tease, but now we really get to get into their world and it makes it something brand new. There's different characters, there's different packs. Like there's so many different ways that you keep us on our toes where it's this long running story, but you have no idea what you're going to get until you pick up the next book.
Well, I'm so grateful to have been given this opportunity to explore the Mercy's world in, I don't know how many books there are now. I think we're running to about, if you count both series, boy, we might be running to about 15 or 16 books, maybe more. Mm-hmm. I don't have the count just off the top of my head. I'm not going to sit here for 20 minutes to try to figure out how many, but it allows me to create these little, you know, as you're writing, you find, you find you run into things, you go, oh, that would be really fun. And I just put it aside. I'm going, oh, some book I'll explore this. And with the long running series, I get a chance to do that. And that's really fun.
Oh, that is cool. If it doesn't quite fit in the book that you're working on, you don't have to abandon it forever. You can just leave it to one side and it'll come up when you sit down to write the next one.
Or the next one after that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and sometimes, exactly.
So, you know, sometimes things have to wait till their proper book. So in Night Broken, Mercy borrows a book, a valuable book from a bookseller who's a friend. To give herself some background on the face she's dealing with. And at the end of that book, was it Night Broken? Maybe it was Iron Kissed. It was Iron Kissed. So she borrowed an Iron Kissed. And the end of Iron Kissed was really fraught. And it just, having her take that book back at the end of the book would have just didn't fit into the end. So I wrote the second book and I sent it into, or the book after that, Night Broken. Bone Crossed. See, I don't know my own books. There's too many of them. I wrote Bone Crossed and I turned it into my editor and she said, oh, this is really good, Patty. And then she stopped and she goes, what happened to that book she borrowed? Because we're all bibliophiles, right? If you borrow a book, you have to return it. And I thought,
oh, that's funny.
So I put a scene in Bone Crossed where Mercy is reading the book. And again, it did not fit for her to return the book just because of the situation and setting in Bone Crossed. But at least everybody knew, I remembered that she had borrowed a book and that she intended to return it. And you would have to wait a little bit for that. And it was just this incidental thing that bothers us book lovers, right? So the next book, the one thing I have to do is make sure she returns that book. And that became the plot of Silverborn, was the start of the plot, was her returning the book. So, you know, things that are small become huge things, right? Which is my favorite thing about not writing.
But that is such a clue. That's exactly what I was about to say. So I have read that you are a pantser, which I can't wrap my head around when you've got not just a really complex series, but you have two series where the plot lines cross. Like these characters are weaving in and out of the same storylines. And that's just existing in your head and isn't planned way ahead of time. Like I'm struggling to wrap my head around how you're doing that.
So, right. So, I actually like the way Jane Yolen put this, and I had never heard this before until I sat in at a Dragon Con. I sat in with her and she said, it's writing into the mist, which I like better because I know some things. I can see some things vaguely. I have things in my head and I know things I want to deal with. I know themes I want to deal with. And then I'm kind of walking into the story. And as we get close, things get clearer and I can understand more about what's going on. I do frequently reread my own books or re-listen to them on audio and take notes about little things that get thrown to the side that obviously are set to be dealt with later. And sometimes I surprise myself. I look at them and I go, wow, I was supposed to deal with this about 10 books ago. I guess I better bring it back. I think it adds to the coherence of the series to have these things that run through multiple books. So I keep a list on the side, mostly in my head, but sometimes writing it down to remind myself of things I have going on that I need to deal with at some point. For instance, Mercy and the Goblin King had this conversation where he gave her information that's really secret amongst the goblins and said it and told her it was because at some point in the future, he knew that she was going to have to trust him. And in order for her to trust him, he had to give her something big. So that's been sitting for two books now. So eventually I'm going to have to pull back up and figure out what it is, when that happens. And I don't really know what it's going to be, but I am aware that that's there. And so my hindbrain is kind of churning through it. And eventually I'll come to a place in a book where it would be really good if she knew that, or if this happened here. So it's not, sorry, I'm not really opposed to planning. I just am opposed to planning minutia, if that makes sense.
No, that if makes total know, sense. And yeah, okay, if like I know there's how these the big book ends, anchor points, but yeah.
Right. That I write in between. And
the rest of the.
Right. If I know how the book ends, I don't have any drive to write it anymore. So if I were a plotter, I would have these elaborate outlines and then I'd be done. I would have no impetus to finish the book. The book that was the hardest for me to write was one that I wrote an outline for. And that one was just miserable for me to write. I didn't want to write it. I just fought it all the way because I knew everything that was going on.
So that's really interesting. I think you already answered this, but it sounds like if you are kind of listening to the books or reading them again, there isn't like I'm envisioning like a massive series Bible where, you know, it's perfectly organized and you've got each of the fae factions and their histories and mythologies and each of the werewolves and their hundreds of years of history. And it sounds like that isn't a thing that's up in Patricia's brain.
Yeah. I do have a couple of aides on my forums a long time ago. One of my wonderful forum people, Linda, who is from Canada and is amazing, went through and started keeping track of all the characters in the book. And there are now in the series, and there are now like pages and pages and pages. And then she would cross-reference it about where you would find references and kind of basic, physical appearance and things like that. And I use that all the time. That is really a useful tool to me. I also have Linda herself online and a couple of other people who know my books better than I do. And so when I'm through with the main draft of the book, I run it through Linda. I run it through my trusty assistant, Sparky Ann Peters, my trusty assistant, Ann, who people will recognize if they go to our Facebook page. A lot of the interaction with fans is Ann, so that I can write and I won't lose myself in Facebook or Twitter. But so I have helpful people. I also have like copy editors who have been with me for multiple books and they will remember things. But mostly it's in my head. And as you probably have noted, you probably can understand, it has become a much bigger deal the last few books that I really have to remember what I wrote before, right? So I live outside town. I drive a lot. I live about a half an hour away from the grocery store and things. So I run audiobooks on my car and I re-listen to my own books so that I can remember what I said.
No, that makes perfect sense. Well, and I bet that is kind of a fun process too, because you'll hear something and be like, oh, I can use that. Like, I forgot I had done that. And now that's perfect for this plot hole that I'm trying to solve right now.
Absolutely. And it also helps me keep the characters in line so that just because it'd be more convenient if this character said that, I don't do that. I have to make sure that it's something that particular person would say. With a long-running series like this, it's not just the main characters everybody knows. A lot of the side characters are really filled out. If I have Ben say something he wouldn't say, or Stefan say something or do something he wouldn't do without a very good reason for that, then that comes back to haunt me. People will say something and I'll go, oh yeah, that's really wrong. He would never do that. And that's hard. I find that it's very important for my ability to keep the stories going, to keep all of the characters straight. And so that I don't feel like I don't fumble with them. For me, to continue to write the Mercy books, they have to be real. And in some part of my brain, this is a real universe with real people. And if I go against that, if for convenience sake, I throw something else in that doesn't feel right to me for the story, then I spend the next 6 months fighting my ability to write further on in it. So I'm pretty careful not to do that. Mm. It does make you feel kind of crazy.
Yeah.
What is it? A writer's the only person in which multiple personality disorder is a good thing, right?
So. It's your career, yeah. We've flirted with the idea of, you know, keeping you off of Facebook or fans recognizing that things may not be authentic for characters. And something I find interesting in authors like you who have a long-running series like this with a huge fan base is, you know, those first couple books you wrote, you were writing them for yourself. You know, maybe they were going to make it out into the world, but it really, there were very few expectations of those books. Now you're on the opposite end of that spectrum where people are really invested in these characters in this world, and there are things they want to happen and things they don't want to happen. And you have a lot of people being very vocal about their feelings about your books. Right. And I wonder how that impacts your writing process and if you're able to kind of tune those expectations out when you're actually doing the work, or if you do think it impacts you.
So it impacts me in as far as I pay attention to the things people like, you know, the kinds of things, especially when I am pushing boundaries one way or the other. And the impact the stories make. And a lot of it is I want to make sure that readers are getting out of the stories the kinds of things that I want them to get out of the stories. And with that in mind, then, when I am sitting down to write the book, I turn it all off. I found that when the books hit the New York Times for the first time, or when it hit USA Today, when I actually started making real money on the books, I had to take all that aside and put it aside and pretend it had nothing to do with the books I was writing. Because if I sit down to write a New York Times, number one New York Times bestselling novel, I can't do that. I just can't do that. I look at the page and I'm going, well, nothing I write is that important. Nothing I write is. When I'm sitting down to write, I have to write for my own entertainment. And if I try to put anything else in it, then the books become stilted and I slow down and I can't make it work. So I really have to write for myself. But while I'm doing that, simultaneously, see, this is the multiple personality thing again, too. Simultaneously, I watch for things that are going to unintentionally offend people. I don't mind offending people intentionally. That's fine. But unintentional offense, I don't want to do. I watch for things like to make sure that the books are not advocating things I don't believe. To make sure things like, you know, when I was in high school, I'm a lot older than you are. When I was in high school, I read a lot of the romance, Harlequin romances, and they've evolved and changed a lot since then. But in a typical Harlequin romance of the 1980s. The man was in his 40s and the girl was 21 at most, no older than 21. And as an 18-year-old myself or 16-year-old myself, I read them and went, oh, that's so cool. That's so cool. That's so cool. And I can remember distinctly sitting in my college room reading an old favorite. And there's a line at the end. He said, you know, they'd been fighting all the way through because that's how the Harlequin romances are. They're the big fights and then they make up, and then big fights and then they make up. And she goes, I understand. I was just being childish. And I stopped and I went, that's because you're a child.
And it's amazing when you have those moments. You're like, this was okay when I was that age.
Right? How creepy is this? How creepy is this? And so when I have a romance between Charles and Anna, so the Wild Sign is an Alpha and Omega book. So I have this romance between Charles and Anna, and Anna is very young. She was in college when she was abducted and changed, and she's in her early 20s when she and Charles meet. And Charles is over 200 years old. And making that relationship work with a power dynamic, a good power dynamic between the two of them has been one of the things I pay a lot of attention to when I'm writing the Alpha and Omegas. And it's, I think to me, that struggle really adds a lot of character to Charles. And, but Anna's got to grow too. So it's, for the first two or three books of that series, that was my main goal, is to make sure that the power dynamics between them were correct, because people read my books. I want them to get an idea of what a healthy relationship looks like from my books. Or if there's an unhealthy relationship, and I have those in the books too, you can tell that they're unhealthy. They're not represented as this is a good relationship. I want to reflect life. I want to have good things and bad things, but I don't want people to look at, say, Bran and Leah's relationship and go, oh, that's what I want between myself and my husband. I want them to be able to, I want people to understand what it is that they're looking at, if that makes sense.
No, it makes total sense. And that care is particularly with, you know, call it an age gap, is apparent. It's something I have been struck by in your writing, where I think it's not uncommon in fantasy to have that age gap where you have a sort of human or immortal turned immortal. But, you know, they're still 25 and you have this powerful being who's like 200 or 300 years old. And like, we just gloss over that. And I didn't feel that way with your books. It's like, this is a struggle, particularly for someone like Charles, where it's like he is self-aware enough to recognize that that is different, but it's love and you can't, you know, you don't get to control who you fall in love with. And
Well, and the secret to that is that he adores her. He thinks she's wonderful. He sees the things that she does for him and his and the wolves, but also he just thinks she's awesome. She pulled a rolling pin out to protect him from a werewolf. I mean, these things matter to him. And because they matter to him, they can matter to the readers. And that keeps their power dynamic where it should be. And it's helpful that she's a werewolf too. So physically, she is capable of protecting herself. Anna is in a much safer position than, say, Mercy is. Because Anna really is physically capable of facing off with monsters and coming out okay. Where Mercy has to rely on being intelligent and having friends and running really fast. So
she's scrappy.
Right?
She goes into the fight and figures out how she's going to win it later.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so far, she's made it.
Yeah.
We'll have to see how that goes.
Yeah. Yeah, she has gotten her ass kicked quite a few times, though.
Oh, yeah. And,
but,
you know,
eventually prevails.
These are things where real life kind of helps you out. I think I've told this story before. And if your readers have heard this before, or your listeners have heard this before, I beg pardon. But my daughter, Amanda, was a gymnast, and she dislocated her elbow. And it popped back in, and she was fine. And she's tough. We kind of forgot about it. And like 2 months later, a month and a half later, she was working on a trampoline and came down funny on one foot and broke her ankle in 3 different places. So we patched her up and put her on crutches and sent her up to college, where she was, community college, where she was finishing her last years of high school at. And she hopped around on crutches all day, and she came back and she said, wow, I don't know why anybody has trouble with crutches. And I said, well, most people aren't 100-pound gymnasts when they go on crutches. And she said, okay. Well, she went down and took a nap, and she woke up screaming in pain because her elbow that she had dislocated decided that it didn't like crutches. So she couldn't use crutches. Her elbow, her whole hand, her whole arm, she couldn't use either. So she was stuck in a wheelchair with one hand, and all she could do was make herself go in little circles. And if we were a kind and compassionate family, we would have said, oh, you poor thing, but we're not. We laughed our butts off at it, right? So at the end of Rivermark, I thought, I'm going to use that. So here's Mercy. She can't move. She's broken her arms. She can't use her hands. She can't use her legs, and she's stuck in a wheelchair. And nobody's tough. I think I sent Adam off. He had to do something. So the whole pack comes and tries to help her, and she sends them away. And because she's the alpha's mate, they all have to go away. And finally they have the vampire come because he's the only one who can like help her go to the bathroom and things. So I'm a terrible person. All the pain and suffering of my family and friends, I use that. That's fun. So
Oh, it's so perfect. Well, and that moment is just so great. Like when you have been with Mercy through these books and you've seen what she's put everybody else through worrying about her. And, right. You know, now she's just absolutely helpless. And you get that kind of moment like you're describing, almost like it's a family member where you get to kind of laugh at her. And
Right. Yeah.
It's very satisfying.
Good. I found it satisfying too. My daughter wasn't as happy with me, but you know.
Oh, I can imagine. But you earned the right to laugh as a parent.
Right. That's what I tell them.
There are some, you know, you said you don't want to unintentionally offend someone. And there are some choices that you've made in the series that have kind of rippled within the fan base of like, oh my God, I can't believe she did this. It sounds like those were intentional and didn't surprise you.
Oh, no. Yes, they were intentional.
Is there any like hesitation when you're going to do that? Are you waiting for the reaction to happen? And, you know, what is the decision-making process to still do it anyway? Is it just like, this is the story and these are the characters?
Well, yeah. And it's, I feel like like I said, the world is true in my head, and it doesn't mean it's real, but it's true. Right. So I have to do the things that are true in that world. We're talking about things like the fact that Bran has romantic feelings towards Mercy. Well, I knew that from the first book. And if you go back and reread the books with that in mind, you can tell. But all of the Mercy books are told first person from Mercy's viewpoint. She has not a clue. She doesn't want to know. She doesn't know all the way through it. And I thought, and I didn't plan on bringing that out until I have Anna and Charles stuck in a car, and I'm going, well, what are they going to talk about? You know, what would be fun for people? What would people want them to talk about? So we talk a little bit about Mercy's history with Bran, because Charles is the perfect witness. He was there for everything, and he's not really impartial, but at least it's not, he's not talking about his own memories, right? And he's pretty clear-eyed. But he, like other people, like everybody, there are things that he doesn't see because he doesn't want to see. And Anna is pretty, because she's dropped into, she hasn't been, you know, boiled on a pot like a frog. These things aren't things that have gradually come to her. She sees the end results and she's like, yeah, I can understand Leah. If you talked about Mercy the way Bran talks about Mercy, I'd be pretty upset with her too. And the world exploded. And I really didn't think that, I didn't think it should be that unexpected. I didn't, because there are lots of clues in the Mercy book that's what's going on. And so it surprised me. What surprised me about that reaction was how many readers had never noticed. And I'm like, okay, that works all right. That works all right. I am really glad that my work does not bore people, because if everything turned out the way readers expected it turned out, you get bored pretty fast.
So one of the other things that I had wanted to ask you about was where are my notes? Which book was it in? Stormcursed. You kind of allude to Adam being a Republican and potentially having voted for someone who sounds a whole lot like Trump. And some readers are really upset by that. And I kind of wonder, like, why did you do that?
You know, Mercy's in a mixed marriage. It's a werewolf and coyote, and it's also Republican. And if Mercy, she'd probably be a liberal Democrat if she voted. I don't like to be on a soapbox and tell people what to think. I like to throw things out there and let people chew on it and see what they think about it. I've known always that Adam was a Republican and that he was very conservative. Most of the werewolves are really conservative in a classic sense, not in maybe the modern Republican sense, but in a classic sense, conservative, you know, small government, no deficit, that kind of thing that we haven't seen from either party for a while. And he's, you know, he's from Alabama. He is 80 years old. In that ballpark, he's not going to be liberal. He's a military man. I don't know why they expected him to not be Republican. I mean, I thought that was kind of written in stone. And I also look around and I have friends who are mixed marriages that way. You know, they're Democrats and married to a Republican, or they're Republicans and married to Democrats. And I think that's really fine. I don't have to have somebody believe everything I believe or think like I do for them to be my friends. I don't have to do that. And it really scared me at that time when I was writing it, how divisive politics had gotten into our country. I mean, there were good things that came out of that. I had a lot of friends who, for the first time in their lives, in their 40s and 50s, figured out how the government worked, figured out how voting worked, figured out how the electoral system worked, actually knew who the vice president was, right? Things like that, which is really a good thing. We had the largest voter turnout we have ever had in this country by percentage and by numbers the last election, which is a great thing. It's a thing to be celebrated. The thing not to be celebrated is when I walk into a group and they look at me and they go, we're all conservative and we all love Trump and you suck. And I'm like, you don't even know me, right? And coming into that kind of a situation, yeah, and starting up I'll start up a political discussion and take names out of it. And we can agree on a lot of things. We can agree on the problems in this country, and we can throw out solutions to it that we may or may not agree on solutions, but we don't yell at each other because we disagree on solutions. We're talking, we have a discourse. And I think we have lost over the last maybe 6 or 7 years, the ability to have a civil discourse on things that people disagree on. So the whole bit where it became obvious that he had voted Republican and probably voted for Trump, was something that I thought was an important thing to bring out, that all of my characters don't believe exactly what I believe, that all of my characters don't have the same values that I have. But they have the values that are a product of their upbringing, a product of their age, a product of their belief system. And I don't expect if my imaginary friends don't all believe like me, then my real friends don't have to all believe like me. And I really hope that's the kind of soapbox I can get behind, that people can say, Adam voted for Trump, or Mercy voted for Hillary Clinton, and I can still like them, right? And the fact that he voted Republican made readers lose their minds is why I did that. That's why I did that. Because I think it's a really sad thing that we can't, overlook that kind of thing. And I speak as a mother of a gay daughter, and who has been appalled by some of the things that have happened over the last 4 years. But most of the things I'm appalled about has nothing to do with the last president being Republican or whatever. It has to do with the way he systematically destroyed our government, which I love. I am not Democrat. I'm not Republican. Most of the Republican and Democratic Party politics make me crazy. But I love our government. The government system that was set up is so freaking resilient, and it really serves the people. And it's run by the people who, like my father, who worked for 45 years in the Forest Service, or people who have been working in the IRS for 30 years, or the State Department for 40 years, who are pretty apolitical. It doesn't matter to them, the 5 or 6 political appointees at the top, the way the machine works is actually very beneficial, very stabilizing, and it keeps our country running. So my objection to the last administration was that he systematically tried to destroy that, if that makes sense. But
yeah, I mean, I think that's where it gets tough, is like, if you pull back and talk about, okay, Adam is a Republican, he voted Republican, in the context of smaller government or fiscal responsibility or that kind of thing, I'm like, okay, I can go with you. Like, these are policies I'm willing to be open-minded about. Right. I think it's when you start looking at it more the lens of like, I mean, like white privilege and marginalized groups, and you know, that you have this specific, not like the Republican Party, but this like very specific polarizing president who is empowering white supremacy.
Yes.
And it's like, okay, it's harder for me to accept that as like a difference of opinion when, you know, one person is like vocally empowering hate groups.
Yes. And you notice that Adam is a little embarrassed about, if you read between the lines, he's a little embarrassed about voting for Trump. I have a lot of friends who think Trump is voted for him as opposed to Hillary, really dislike him, but they like some of his policies. My own view on this, as a history major, I'm trying to be pretty, as a non-political person, or at least I don't jump up and down and say my party is. My problem with Trump is that the last 6 years, 5 years, I'm including the election, we have had a demagogue in office. This is a friend of mine explained it. He's a Biden supporter, and he said the difference between normal politics and what happened with Trump is if Joe Biden told me to go and attack the Capitol, I wouldn't do it, right? I would laugh at him and wouldn't do it. The fact that Trump has people who are so pro-Trump that they don't pay any attention to what he's doing. They don't pay any attention to what he says. Whatever he says is right. And that is a very dangerous, that's a cult thing. Whenever you give up your free agency, whenever right. you give up your decision-making process in order to whatever comes out of this person's mouth is right, that's a scary, dangerous thing. As a, to me, that is the definition of evil. Is that people give up their decision-making processes in order to follow absolutely somebody else, that somebody else takes away their free agency there. That's where it turns evil, when someone else takes away your free agency. I spent my college years in Bozeman, Montana, and just up the road in Livingston, which is literally like a half an hour away, there was a cult that came over from California and tried to take over Livingston, which is a little bit too big for them. And so they moved to Ennis, which is outside of Yellowstone Park, and took over this little town. And they were a doomsday cult. And for a while in Bozeman, Montana, if you wanted to be a millionaire, you started a construction company building fallout shelters. And I'm not kidding. I knew several professors at Montana State who were millionaires because they also on the side built fallout shelters. And,
wow.
Right? And I dealt intimately with a lot of these people because I was supporting one of the weird jobs I had is I worked as a manager of a used bookstore who also sold coins and then silver and gold. So, and they would exchange, they were part of this was that the financial system was going to fall down. And so they exchanged all their paper money for junk silver, which is like the old silver dimes and quarters, old quarters, and for gold and silver bullion. So I dealt with these people a lot, and it amazed me how happy they were to give up all responsibility for their life. And that was what they were getting out of this, is that I don't have to make decisions anymore. I don't have to be responsible for anything that happens in my life because I am following this person and it was a scary thing to watch. So, that's another thing you'll probably see in my books is that to me, the ultimate evil is somebody who takes away or makes other people want to give up their right to make their own decisions. Mm. Sorry.
No.
Soapbox. I mean,
yeah, that definitely is a thread through the books.
Right. And,
no, well, and it's hard too, because I think like you made a decision to write that years ago and then a book sort of exists in the now, no matter when you wrote it. So
correct.
Someone reading it right after the insurrection is going to have a different experience of that than reading it, you know, three years ago.
For sure. And, you know, the nice part about having the characters the way, I can tell you how Adam would react to the insurrection. And you probably know too, right? Do you think he would be one of the people breaking into the Capitol? Absolutely not.
No.
I look at his character more as like maybe a general, General McCaffrey or Mattis, where it's just because he voted that way does not mean that he supports that person right or wrong. That's not correct. You want your country to be run correctly, right? And
that moment, do you think Adam would regret having voted for Trump?
Oh yeah, he does, for sure. Well, But okay, I'm going to stop and take a step back and say, all right, I'm speaking from character viewpoint, not from my own viewpoint. Mercy would every day, all day long, vote for Hillary Clinton. It would not bother her at all. Adam had no problem in 2016, if we put him in our real world. He would have no problem in 2016 voting for Trump over Hillary Clinton. He would have rather voted for Bush, the other Bush son who was running. He would at the time probably rather have voted for Ted Cruz. At this point, that would not be the case. He would have voted for, he voted McCain, had no problem
voting
McCain.
Adam would never go to Mexico when his state was in trouble.
What's that? Oh yeah, Cruz went to Mexico when his state was in trouble. Yeah, no way. That's not okay.
Yeah, Adam.
Duty is really important to him. And so, you know, you go out and you vote, that's your duty. And if you're given two candidates, neither one you like, you vote for the one you think will do the least harm. And a lot of people, I think, in the last election, not this last election, but 2016, went out to vote for the person who did least harm. Boy, this is getting political. Well, I'll move on from this.
I know. I'm going pull it back.
Right, exactly.
I know readers right now are like, why are you making her talk about politics?
Exactly. So we're writers and we're artists, and that's what we do, is we bring up hot buttons and we throw things up and let people deal with the fallout. I didn't have Adam go on a pro-Trump rant. Just like Mercy would never go on a pro-Hillary rant in the books, because I don't think that's appropriate. I don't mind shoving them and making them uncomfortable here and there, but I don't want my friends who are Republicans to read my books and say, I can't read these anymore because I feel like you're lecturing at me all the time. And I don't want my friends who are Democrats to read my books and say, I can't read these anymore because I feel like you're lecturing me all the time. That's not the point of my books. That's not the point of the way I write. What I want to do is throw up ideas and make people think and make people see the other side, or make people see how they feel about things. I'm not going to make a big deal about, unless in the future it becomes another big deal in my life. I probably won't bring up politics at all ever again in the Mercy books. I just felt like it was important to get some balance if I'm going to put some left-wing stuff in there, I need to put some right-wing stuff in there too.
It's interesting that it was conscious like that. That was how it was framed in your mind. But it's hard because I know there are a lot of people listening who are saying like, why, like leave politics out of it. We've had enough politics. But it's difficult because art is inherently political. Like if you, by not saying anything, you are saying something.
Agreed.
So
yeah.
It's, you know, as a creator, you are... creating these characters in this world and making people think, and you can't help but be political.
Well, and the whole point of urban fantasy is that it's a crossover between the real world and the things that come out at night. And if you don't bring the real things in from the real world, then the ghosts and the vampires and the werewolves don't feel real either. So if you bring in things that are important in the real world, it makes the rest of the stuff, all the lies I tell you, makes them feel true, right? So if I leave out important things that are happening in the world, I just feel like it says something, like you said, it's saying something too. I don't mind touching on uncomfortable subjects. I do mind ramming them down people's throats.
Yeah, I think... it is interesting kind of pulling away from that and into the world a little bit. You know, we're in this space where the mythological creatures have come out to the human population, and the humans predictably are being humans about it, and you know, are not as accepting. They are making this a nightmare for these creatures who could crush them if they really wanted to. And in a way, humans are sort of villains in this series. And I find that really interesting to think about.
It's a viewpoint thing, right? So I'm telling the stories from the viewpoints of the monsters. And Mercy is about as close to a human viewpoint as I get. And you can, every once in a while, she'll say, you know, they're right. They're right to be afraid of the vampires and the werewolves, probably not so much. Although, if the humans weren't as much a threat, maybe the werewolves would be more of a threat, if that makes sense. The things, all of the rules that Bran has imposed upon the werewolves are designed to keep the humans happy with them, are designed to make them safe, right? if the humans decided to be, say, all fanboys of werewolves, then that impetus is gone. Then they can be as bad as they want to be. And the same thing goes for the vampires. If the vampires were out and people went, ooh, you know, if everybody treated them like the Twilight vampires, right? Then there's no impetus for them to to toe the line and not to be as bad as they can be, and to hide what they are. And as long as you're hiding things, you're not. It's you're making it small. It's a less evil. They can't go out, for instance, and take. Well, maybe I should do that. That's actually good. Okay, so if the vampires went out and took over a very small town, then they could have all the humans as their fodder, and they could breed them, and they could have these human herds and do all of these horrific things, right? So having the humans there to kind of put a line which we can't cross, and you might actually see that in another book. That sounds like a really fun thing to do in a few books. Because we're dealing with as the viewpoint creatures are werewolves and vampires, you see them as the opposing force, right? Or as the ultimate scary thing, because as long as nobody scares the humans too badly, we can all coexist. But if you scare the humans too badly, then you end up with you end up with mass killings, and you end up with bombing ferry and things like that. That humans are very capable of destroying all of these nasty creatures with our big population and our nasty nuclear weapons and things like that. So it is it's a game balance. It provides game balance for my stories.
Yeah. Well, and it is. It's like those alliances have to shift based upon, you know, one group does something stupid and the others have to then kind of ally in order to keep that balance in place. And it just makes it so much more complicated in a good way.
It's fun. In a happy, happy, joy world in which nothing bad ever happened, there would be no stories.
As you're writing into The Mist, as you explained earlier, does The Mist end at any point? Like, do you have a vision of how, like, do these storylines wrap up at some point? Or is it just what happened 2 minutes ago and you go, oh, that would be fun, that would be fun, and that they just keep going on these adventures forever because they're immortal and you can do that?
Right. Or at least they can go on adventures until I die. So yeah, I don't have an end for this series. I know that several really good series have been pulled to an end at about this point. But I think that I don't have one overwhelming arc. I have arcs for two or three books, and then I'll pick something else up and we'll do, and I may do a couple independent books that are completely independent, and then a couple arcs, or do what I did with the last bunch with the Hardesty Witches, where they started in, they started a long time before that, but they started majorly in Alpha and Omega series and Burn Bright, and then they went over to the Storm Cursed with Mercy. And so I might have like series of books that cross over from one set of books to the other set of books, or whatever tweaks my fancy at the time. But I don't have an end in place. I suspect it will end if I get bored, or if the readers get bored, we'll move on to something else and maybe come back to it. But I just have a new contract coming up for another three books, two in the Mercy and one in the Alpha and Omega. So not in the foreseeable future.
Not anytime soon. Yeah.
Yes.
That's cool.
Yes.
Is there like another idea or another world that tweaks at your brain, but you just don't have the time or the space to write it right now? Or are you really happy in this world and
well,
it doesn't matter?
Yeah, absolutely. There's always stories. You know, if you're a writer, if you're a storyteller, you have stories going in your head all the time. I have a couple of traditional stories that I've been kind of mulling over for a while. There are sequels to books I've written before. Like I want to do a second Hobbs Bargain. To tie up that story correctly, I want to do, I have some more dragon bones, dragon blood. I have some more books in that I have, kind of planned out. I have a whole nother series of the Raven books. I have a whole nother series set in that world that I have some thoughts about. And then I have one that's, absolutely nothing that I have written before, and probably I don't know that it's even publishable. But I it's one of the stories I work on when I go to bed and waiting to, you know, fall asleep. So yeah, there's always other things, but the Mercy books are really fun. And like I said, the nice part about them is I can write whatever kind of story I want to. If I want to write a spy story, I can write a spy story. If I want to write a huge epic story, I can write a huge epic story, or I can have some epic things going on. I really, really enjoy working in this world that is so rich, because I've written so many books in it. There's so much for me to play with. I had an experience where I was listening to my friends. Well, I was at my friend's house when they were watching. George Martin, Game of Thrones. They were watching Game of Thrones they were watching the HBO series. And when the villain worm tongue like character, I can't think of his name just offhand, who's been the villain all the way through for like 7 years, he dies. And I would tell you that there was a ripple effect that went not from just the living room of my friend's house, but like all the way through the city and all the way through the world when that happened. You could just feel everybody take a breath when that happened, because it was such a big moment that could not have happened if it had not been like 7 years in the making. And the same things works for the books. You know, there are things that very powerful things that I can do because they've been building up for all of these books. And that's really trippy. That's really fun. I have Wild Sign. The end of Wild Sign is going to make people, is a game changer, and people are going to have a lot of fun with it. I hope. I had a lot of fun. My friends who have read it said, oh, so, at the end of Wild Sign is something that I've known is going to happen. And I meant to put it in this, in like two books before, and it didn't quite fit. So I just held it off. And I was actually working on the very last chapter of this one. And I thought, I could stick it here. So that's what I did. So it's at the end of Wild Sign is this big kind of world-changing event, I hope, and we'll see what happens.
This is kind of coming out of left field, but have you guys explored at any point doing Mercy as TV or film or graphic novels or like any other mediums?
Yeah. Media? So there was a production company that had the rights to the Mercy series. And when I do that, it's got to be both. I mean, the way the film industry works, if they have the rights to Mercy, they have the rights to Alpha and Omega too. There's too many interchanging characters, too much interchanging world. They have the whole bunch. And I had somebody who had the rights to that they paid me $30,000, and it cost me $28,000 for my lawyer to go through the contract to make sure it was okay. So it was a zero sum game for me, but at least it was a good contract. But the strike happened. This was back in like 2007. There was a big strike that happened, and the company that held that contract broke up, and they went with it for a few more years, and nothing happened, and I got all the rights back, and now somebody else is shopping it around, and it looks like it might be a successful thing, but I can't. Hollyweird is Hollyweird. I never count on anything until the cameras start rolling. And even then it's kind of like, so it's a fun thing. And if I get anything solid on that, I promise I will let everybody know. But yeah, there have been little things in the works for quite a long time, but nothing serious. So
yeah, it's like the opposite of publishing. Like in Hollywood, it's like everything is yes, 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 and it's going, and then it just like fizzles out of nowhere and never goes anywhere. And publishing, it's like no, 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 and you just need that one yes, and then it happens.
Exactly, like, exactly, exactly. And in publishing, you get a yes, and you know it's a go. And it really, mm-hmm. it goes through. And in Hollyweird, you get yeses, and that doesn't mean yes. So
yeah, people like to say yes just to like blow smoke up each other's asses, and then
right. So when money starts changing hands, that's when I believe it. So other than that, yeah, I think it would be really fun. It's a dangerous thing, I think, for a writer, for somebody else who is creative, to get their hands on your characters and on your plots. And I think that I'm not one of the writers who've always wanted to write Hollywood scripts or anything like that. So I'll stay out of it. But it's so in some ways, it really doesn't break my heart if it never goes. Because it's like giving your children to somebody else.
I mean,
you
definitely have to be comfortable with people putting their own. You have to find that exciting and like be excited by the changes that people make and their own creative vision on it.
Right. And if I were not a control freak, I wouldn't be a writer. So it doesn't warm the cockles of my heart. So.
I feel like we've just barely scraped the surface of things we can talk about with you, but I want to be respectful of your time. I did not get to just pick your brains about Bran, and I'm going to kick myself for it. He's my favorite character. I am endlessly fascinated by Bran.
So Wild Sign should be really fun for you. Wild Sign goes into a lot of, Bran and Leah's past. It's the story of Bran and Leah and how they came to be in many ways. So hopefully you'll enjoy it. Bran is a really fun character. I've had a lot of fun with him. I will never write a book that's just a Bran-centric book because I think it would ruin him. I think it's much more fun to have him on the periphery where you don't know everything and you discover new things all the time. I think that's a better way to go.
Well, it's like that's how he would want it. And he like enjoys being underestimated. And I love it when like at the opening of Wild Sign, you have FBI agents who are in Anna and Charles's house. And they're kind of asking Anna, like, are you the Merrok? Merrok? Is that how I say it?
Merrok, yeah. Uh-huh.
And Bran is like lingering outside on the porch and is amused by this. And I think he comes in eventually and says something to them and then leaves. And like their minds are blown that this guy is Merrok.
Right. He looks like the pizza delivery boy. Yeah.
Exactly. I loved that description. And I mean, the same thing, like in the Prague book, he just gets away with like blending into the background and the idea that there's this like massively powerful, controlled, like being with all of this history. And he's, I don't know, holding in his mind all of these different people's needs and how to like use them to get other people what they need. Like, he's just fascinating. And he doesn't care if people think he's the pizza boy.
Right. And he says, you know, if I had to describe Bran in one word, it would be zealot. His whole focus is the survival of the werewolves. And zealots get things done. They are really uncomfortable people to be around. They're really uncomfortable people to be around. And what makes Bran work as a character is the times in which that doesn't work. Like in Silence Fallen, when he puts his own needs, Mercy's needs, but his own needs in front of the thing that has been driving his life for centuries. That's really cool. I mean, to me, that's really cool. That's what makes them real people instead of cartoon characters, is when they have these guiding principles of their lives and then with sufficient reason, they break them. And that's, I love writing
Bran. And what
Bran.
Is the reason? Yeah.
Right,
like
right.
What, and that shows you what drives him. And,
yes.
You know, there's like what he thinks drives him. And then there's this other thing that he just can't control within the depths of him where he breaks from that.
Right. Just like all of us. Right. So, yeah, no, I have so much fun with these characters. I have so much fun with the characters. The other one I really love to play with is Wolf, because he's so broken. And at the same time, he's so powerful and creepy and weird and trying to figure out, I know what drives him. I know what's making him tick, but it's really hard from the outside looking in to figure it out. So sometimes he is a staunch ally and sometimes he is the one who's making all the bad things happen. And it's really hard to tell which way he's going to go. I used him in the last book in Smokebitten. I was worried that Aiden was getting to be too powerful. The boy rescued from the Fae, who is fire, right? And I thought, well, we need to let people know that there is a limit, that he's not just like a fire god, that there's a limit. And so I had this confrontation between him and Wolf, who is, when it comes down to it, just a vampire. And Aiden didn't win on that confrontation. And I just like doing that, throwing things together and seeing what happens and make sure that the results are unexpected. It amuses me, and hopefully it makes people have fun and come back to it.
Yeah. Do you have time to answer our kind of wrap up questions that
we
do?
I sure do. Let's do
random questions to get to know you better.
Sure.
Who is the best villain ever?
El Gallo from The Fantastics. And my favorite part about
him. I don't know that one.
Oh, you know what? You probably do. It had the longest run. I think it held the record for the longest run of any musical. It's like 42. I'm sorry. Somebody just rang the doorbell. I'm going to ignore them. Like 42 okay. years. It ran for 42 years. And one of the songs is, if you remember, then try to remember. That probably should ring something. Mm. If I were a better singer,
okay.
it would ring.
Yeah, yeah.
El Gallo, the plot line is this. There is a young girl and a boy and their neighbors, and their parents think that they should be a couple, but they don't pay any attention to each other. So the parents decide they're going to have a feud like Romeo and Juliet. And if they're forbidden each other, maybe they'll get together. And they end up hiring this carnival bandit to kidnap her, the girl, and to help the father's plot to set up a situation in which the boy can come and rescue the girl. And all the way through, as watchers, we see the villain falling in love with this girl. And he's very straightforward. When the parents come up to him and are paying him to kidnap their daughter, he said, well, you can call it abduction. You can call it this without another thing. But really, it's rape. And he's right. They are asking him to violate her sense of safety in order to gain this goal of theirs. And so it's this wonderful contrast. So there'll be parts of it that just feel like really light and fluff, fluff, fluff. And then they'll bring up something to say, you know, that clarifies everything. And El Gallo is one of the characters that breaks the third wall all the time. He'll stop, everything stops, everything freezes behind him. He'll go and he'll talk to the audience and explain the hidden depths of what's going on in the story. And as you're going along, she falls in love with him. And you think he falls in love with her too. And in the very end scene, she thinks she's going off with him and he betrays her utterly. And because of that utter betrayal, she looks at the boy next door and realizes what a good guy he is. And he is. What a really nice guy he is. And they go off together. And El Gallo comes back. It's been out for 42 years, people. If you haven't seen it, this shouldn't ruin your day.
He comes out. Spoiler alert.
and he comes out to the audience, and very poetically, what he says is, I don't have the exact words, but he said, you know, spring is born of winter. Isn't it an odd thing that in order to grow, we have to die a little? And you understand at the very end that he was in love with her too, but that wasn't his position. It's not for him. He's not the hero of the story. He's the villain. And he set it up so that they could have this happy ever after. And he goes off alone again. It's a really wonderful musical, and the music is great. The music is great. And you really like all the characters. But El Gallo is to me, my favorite kind of villain, in that at first you think he's just a villain. He's doing bad things for bad reasons. And then you find out he has real reasons that are understandable, that are even admirable for doing what he's doing. It does not make him the good guy. He still breaks her heart. He still hurts her. He still does terrible things. But that's his job. And I love it. I just love that character. And I love complicated
villains. I love that too. Oh my gosh.
Right? So now you have to go watch The Fantastics. I'm sure that there are.
Like you're speaking to me here.
Right? I'm sure there's.
Oh my gosh.
I think they've made several films. So yeah. But if you get a chance to see it as a play, a real musical, go do it. And the title, it took me years to remember that the play went with Fantastic. The title is a really weird title to go with that musical. But Awesome. Hmm.
Interesting. Oh, that's such a good answer. And it's opened something new up for me. So that's really cool.
Oh, good. Well, I hope all your audience goes and watch the Fantastics. Interesting.
Oh, yeah. We group watch. What is the most interesting object in your workspace?
Probably the carousel horse. You can see it behind me. The audience will be able to see it.
There is a carousel horse behind her.
So I have several of them. I have a number of them. I've got a very good friend who carves carousel horses. And we met him actually when we bought a carousel horse from him. We were going to build a carousel, my husband and I. And if my husband were still around, we would be building a carousel. I don't have the time or the technical expertise to do it. And I may do it maybe 10 or 15 years in the future. But we acquired a couple of carousel mechanisms and carousel horses. I think I have maybe 10 or 15 figures at this point in time. I just love them. I think they're beautiful. And my friend is, I think, the best carousel carver that there has ever been. His horses are just amazing. His wife runs the Santa Monica Pier Carousel. If you ever see a Hollywood movie with carousel in it, almost always it's the Santa Monica Pier Carousel in there. And she runs it, and then he does all the repair work on it. It's and all the restoration work. But anyway, Ed Roth.
Wow.
So I love carousel horses. Huh.
It is beautiful. It reminds me, I lived in France as a child for a little while, and outside one of the palaces, there was this just like classic carousel that looked very much like the one that's behind you. And I had like a favorite horse that I always had to ride, and we would like wait if someone else was on it because I had to ride my horse. And yeah.
Carousels are magic. There is no doubt. Every time everybody I talk to remembers that childhood carousel horse. I had one too. There was Butte, Montana had a carousel, and we all waited to ride the black one. I mean, we all did. It was fun. And if you hear interviews with people from Butte, they'll talking about the carousel, they'll go, everybody had a favorite carousel horse, but mine was, and I'm going, it's the black one. Mine was the black one. Yeah. I know exactly which carousel horse that was. It's pretty funny. So
everybody's was the same.
But they're magic. They're magic. And they're interactive art, which makes them awesome.
Yeah. No, it's fun now. My kids are at that age. They're like 3 and 5, and obviously not so much now in COVID times, but there was this beautiful carousel at one of the zoos that we went to recently. And it's just so fun, like now getting to see it from the parent side and them like watching that magic come to life.
Right. I don't think any carousel is alive. No carousel is really working unless it's filled with children and going and music playing. It's just, I love it.
Yeah. What scares you in like a minutia way, not in like an existential crisis way?
Okay. A minutia way. Spiders in the house. We have a lot of black widows and I don't like spiders in the house. Mm-hmm. I have a visceral memory so I sometimes have trouble sleeping. I didn't want to disturb anybody. So I'll go and I'll read in the bathroom. You know, I just sit down and read. And about 2 o'clock in the morning one night, I was reading in a bathroom and I heard the skitter, skitter, skitter. And I thought, what is that? Skitter, skitter, skitter. And I looked up and there was a spider on the floor and it was big enough to make skittery noises. So,
no.
Yeah. Nope.
Not, too big to live.
Yep. Outside, I don't care. They don't bother me outside. It's the idea of sleeping with a spider. No.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm the same way. I'm great with spiders outside. But
and Mike always used to say, you're a lot bigger than that spider.
Oh. Right. It doesn't matter.
It
don't
doesn't
be logical.
Matter. No, right? Thank you.
What was the last book that kept you up reading?
I just finished, and I read late at night on it, T. Kingfisher. If you've never read any of her books, do. They're wonderful. The new one that just came out is Paladin Strength. She's just a wonderful writer. She has these wonderful characters, and her books are just a joyous journey through them with really scary moments. She does horror. She does creepy things in the books, but her characters are just the kind of people that you love. They're wonderful. Her voice is wonderful. I just think that she's amazing.
Hmm.
See my camera keeps crying.
Is there anything that you irrationally hate?
Anything I irrationally hate? Okay. Crowds. Crowds of people I don't like at all. So when I went to Comic-Con the first time,
San Diego Comic-Con.
Yes, that was true pre-COVID. Oh. I know post-COVID, I have friends who are like, it's going to be years before I can go into the restaurant again. And I'm looking at them and going, you have both COVID shots. And they're like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I walk into a restaurant and my stomach clenches. And I think that's going to be true of a lot of people. Yeah.
But Comic-Con is, yeah, like I like the idea. I live in San Diego now.
Yes.
And like, I like the idea of going to Comic-Con, but then yes. I see the pictures and the videos of it. And I'm like, no, can't do it. Can't do it. Too many people.
130,000 people in one room. 130,000 people in one room. And all I can see is somebody says fire. You know, it's going to be bad.
No, exactly. Yeah, I have this fear of mobs, like that mobs can just like humans all moving together, get really irrational.
I don't think that's irrational. I think that's a total rational fear. I mean, look at the Capitol riots. That's a totally rational fear. The people who died, other than the police officer, the people who died in the Capitol riots died because they were trampled, you know?
Yeah.
No. I was at New York Comic Con in the big center there that they have everything in down in Manhattan. And they had the Artist Alley in a little separate part of the building than everything else. And there was this tunnel that went from one place to the others. And I'm sure for other events, it was a perfectly adequate tunnel. For Comic-Con, it was not a perfectly adequate tunnel. I got in there
and it was crowded front
and crowded back and you had no space. And we just kind of shuffled all the way through that tunnel, scared me to death. And then I had to go back and do it again to get out of there. Oh, no.
Oh, you just kind of have to think about it as you're doing it.
Right? Yeah, no. it was, you know, I'll do those things, but it doesn't mean that they're not terrifying and that I like doing them. So,
yeah. If I was going to use an object to summon you with a spell, what would it be?
Oh my goodness. I would like to think of something cool, but maybe my glasses, something that belongs to me, maybe my glasses. I had LASIK surgery 3 or 4 years ago, and now I have presbyopia. But I find when I sat down to do this interview with you, I kept putting my glasses down because I'm like, I don't need them. And I don't. These are just so that I can read letters and things. I can see you perfectly well, but I need my defensive glasses on. So, yeah.
That's so interesting.
Right?
So it's like a reassurance or a comfort thing. Now.
Right. Exactly. So glasses would probably be it. Or a book. You could probably summon me with a book, especially if it was a good one. You know, Secret Garden, something by Bujold. Go ahead.
What's a movie that you would watch every day?
Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
Yeah.
What if I made you like pick a section? Like
which
I have
section?
A particular section that I like. I'm a Helm's Deep girl. I will go back and rewatch Helm's Deep.
I love Helm's Deep. I think that's so beautiful. It's so wonderful. I like the fight with and I think that's Helm's Deep too, where Legolas is using the shield like it was a surfboard. I really love that.
Yeah.
I really love that. I loved let's see. I love any of the battles were amazing. I love the scene when they first come and meet Galadriel. And Galadriel and he offers her the ring. I just think that's very powerful. And I love Kate Blanchett anyway. And I did before Lord of the Rings. And Lord of the Rings did not change my opinion of her acting abilities at all. I love that. I really like when they're in the mountains in the snow and ice traveling those little trails and they come to the and they come to they come to the dwarven home, and I cannot remember right this second what it's called, where they're facing the big gates.
Moria.
Thank you. The Mines of Moria. That whole travel sequence, I really think they did a beautiful job of it. Just, it feels like a long journey. It feels like a terrible journey. As a writer, I really appreciate the illusion, you know, that in time, it doesn't actually take that long, but you're exhausted as a watcher of the movie. You're exhausted by the time they reach that. But I love it all. I don't think that there's a moment that I dislike it. In fact, when I get, when I don't feel like I can tell stories, when I get just, there's nothing left in my pot of energy for storytelling, I'll sit down and watch 10 or 15 minutes of Lord of the Rings. And I don't let myself watch the whole thing anymore because I'm afraid it'll lose its magic. But I always come out of there. There's such powerful storytelling taking place in the Lord of the Rings that I come out of it and it's just like, it fills me right back up and I get up and I can go write more Mercy or more Anna and Charles and just have a good time with it. It's just magic. I just love that movie. I think it's wonderful.
It's interesting. It does the exact same thing for me. And I think of it the same way. Like if I need to refill the well, I just need, and like different sections of it fill different needs.
Yes.
And
yes.
You just, yeah, it like,
the wonderful voiceovers,
storyteller side of you.
The wonderful voiceovers they have, like when they're telling the story of how Gollum, I think it's in the beginning of the third movie, when they're telling the story of how Gollum became Gollum. It's beautiful. Lovely.
Yeah, so good. Last question. Who is someone that you professionally admire? Like someone you look up to?
Oh, everybody. CJ Cherry, Carolyn Cherry, who's a friend of mine. She's so, her storytelling is so solid. It's so good. And she asks big questions and doesn't lose track of the characters, you know, doesn't lose track of the fact that stories are about people. And she's still dealing with the big issues. I love her stuff. I love Lois McMaster Bujold. If I wake up someday and can write as one story as well as she writes her books, I will be so happy. I love everything she writes. I'm having so much fun with her Penrick books, her novellas. She's got a whole series of novellas. She was freed. She has enough money to live on. So she is writing the things that she wants to do. And the Penrick's Demon, I think, is the first one. And they're amazing. They're just wonderful. She has this wry eye that she puts on the world. And I love Miles Borkosigan with every beat of my heart. Military science fiction, but they were just this wonderful series based around the single character, Miles Borkosigan, who is one of my favorite characters ever made. He's just terrific. A really smart character who gets himself into trouble because he's really smart is so much fun to watch. Jim Butcher.
Definitely.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know either of these authors. So
oh,
that's
you have
exciting.
To go. Oh, well, good. You have to go. CJ Cherry's classic. Classic science fiction. Wonderful. Lois McMaster Bujold writes great fantasy and writes science fiction that I make a lot of my fantasy friends who say they'll never read science fiction read her books and they turn into fervent fans too. I don't even know where to tell you to start. I would start in I won't tell you where to start. Just wherever, because you pick up, they're all good.
I'll just have to go.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
See what sounds right.
And then Jim Butcher, of course. Yeah. He was just an amazing, he's awesome. But I could list, like, sit here and have about 50 or 60 of them. It just depends on what strikes me as we talk, right?
Yeah. So just to repeat it, the latest book that has just come out as we're releasing this is called Wild Sign. We're back to Anna and Charles, so it's an Alpha and Omega book. And like you said, we get a lot of Leah and Bran. We are in one of those like adventures where we're off in a slightly different setting. There's a mystery. It's, you know, all the kind of adventure and intensity that you would expect from this world.
Thank you very much. I had a lot of fun with it.
And yeah, it, by the time we release this, the book will be out. So you guys should go check it out. And if people want to keep up with you online, where is the best place for them to do that?
Probably a Facebook, which is the official Patricia Briggs. And then there are several children boards, like I think the official Patricia Briggs spoiler page is up there for those who don't mind spoilers. And there's the fan official Patricia Briggs fan page. Be a little careful. We just yesterday had somebody open a Patricia Briggs author site and then ask for people, friend people, and then ask them for their personal information so they could send them a copy of the book. So don't do that. I will never ask you for personal information. I promise you. So be cautious while you're online. But and my website is patriciabriggs.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. It's been really cool.
Jenny, thank you very much for setting this up, for doing all the work. And I feel like I just babbled at you for however long we've been on, but I had a great time.